Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, continuing our discussion on cancers now. The first cancer research center founded by a university in the U.S. was right here in Wisconsin, as I mentioned. The UW-Carbone Cancer Center has been around in various forms for over 90 years. And joining us to talk about the center is its director, Dr. Howard Bailey. As we talk with Dr. Bailey, I hope you'll join in. Have you participated in a clinical study at the Carbone Cancer Center? What was your experience like? What questions do you have about the center? Love to hear from you. You can join in by calling us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Howard Bailey, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry.
It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Thinking about the name of the center, I've been around doing this show long enough that I had many opportunities to interview and talk with Dr. Paul Carbone, who was a great, great guy in my estimation. And, of course, he was a brilliant researcher. So he's part of the history. Maybe we can talk about the history of the UW-Carbone Cancer Center, just to begin.
Thank you, Larry. Just to kind of mention and to give credit where credit's due, the University of Wisconsin has really had an incredibly long and rich history of really kind of forward-thinking cancer-related research and care. And much of it started with a local Wisconsinite by the name of Dr. Harold Rush, who was born around the Wausau area. And Dr. Rush put together the Department of Oncology, and which later became the McArdle Laboratories for Cancer Research, and which still exists today. And that was really, we think, the first university-based cancer-only department in the world at its when it started in the 30s and 40s, and then went on to develop, again, really grow the McArdle Labs, which is still one of the preeminent basic and translational cancer research centers and groups in the world, and eventually led Dr. Rush to recruiting Dr. Paul Carbone, as you'd mentioned, Larry, who was one of the first cancer clinical researchers or cancer physicians at the National Cancer Institute in the late 50s and early 1960s. And Dr. Carbone came here to work with Dr. Rush in the mid to late 70s and then took over the cancer center for which we're named, which is that we are one of the first National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer centers in the country going back more than 40 some years.
And when we say comprehensive, what does that designation mean?
So what it there are various types of National Cancer Institute designated centers. They can be very basic in nature, or they can be initial centers or comprehensive. And what it means, Larry, is that peer or other cancer physicians, researchers, educators from around the country come and evaluate you. And if you achieve a certain level of excellence or expertise across all aspects of cancer care, cancer research from very basic to clinical to community or population-based, including cancer education, both of future generations but also of communities, that's how you can then achieve this National Cancer Institute comprehensive designation.
So it's pretty darn cool to have.
Well, we're proud of it, and the people and the community that we represents, because so we are around 300 faculty here at the University of Wisconsin that vary from very basic researchers studying why a cell does what it does to clinicians, some you were just talking to, who are doing great clinical care and great clinical research. And so we're proud of what we do, but we also know that there's great physicians and great health systems all throughout our state. And our job is to kind of, in addition to provide great care, but to really work on providing innovation. What are the treatments or the preventions or the diagnostic tools that all of us can benefit from tomorrow? and we need to be working on those today.
Jim in Green Bay has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Jim, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm calling about the predecessor to the McArdle. I've heard stories for years about a Dr. Hansfield who supposedly started the cancer research.
Thank you for the question. Dr. Fred Hansfield was one of the original cancer researchers here and was a part of that, working with Dr. Harold Rush. So Dr. Harold Rush was recruited literally almost out of medical school and then got in and brought in other clinicians and researchers. That has helped lead to a lot of the work. And Dr. Hansfield being one of those original pioneers here at the University of Wisconsin working with it. But so Dr. Rush literally was one of the first. Another one that you might have heard of as Dr. Fred Mose, who began in the 30s, started the procedure that is used for skin cancer removal that's literally used around the world and called Mose surgery. So there were quite a few pioneers in the 30s and 40s, including Dr. Hansfield.
Oh, interesting. Jim, thank you. Annie in La Crosse, on to you.
Hi. Say, my father died of colon cancer at 56, and now my son is going to be 46, and his insurance won't pay for a screening until he's 50. How concerned should we be? And is there any way to beat the system and get them to pay for it?
So, again, I'm sorry to hear that unfortunately you've been touched so directly by cancer. So it's a good question. You know, I'm not going to pretend to understand all the aspects of economics and other things when it comes to health, but when you've got a family history like that, it is kind of natural for any of us to want to look at, can we head this off even sooner? So there is a growing evidence and data to support your contention, and there are some that are really pushing at national levels that colorectal cancer screening, when you have a family history, should start at age 45. One of the ways to kind of look at that with your health insurers is to pull some of the things that are you hear out in the public press, because both from the National Cancer Institute or the American Cancer Society, there is some growing data to support that. At a minimum, whether it's some of the newer, less invasive procedures that could be looked at, if somebody doesn't have a history of polyps, there is obviously here in our, you know, own state of Wisconsin, the Cologuard with Exact Sciences. There's the other stool testing. There's the virtual colonoscopy as well. But I would certainly support your contention of wanting to have your son screened earlier. As we all know, there's a kind of a lot of moving parts to that. But there is increasing data, because for the reason you state, there's evidence to suggest that the colorectal cancer incidence is increasing in men and women from 20 to 40. Again, it's still rare, fortunately, but it is happening sooner and sooner. So I would certainly, given your family history, support your son being screened, if I remember right, at age 46.
Yeah. Good luck, Annie. Thank you for calling. Wasn't the National Cancer Act? That was passed, 50 years ago?
Correct. In the early 70s, and again, just for our listeners, there's a lot of Wisconsin legacy to that. One of the real people who pushed it at the national level was a woman by the name of Mary Lasker, who's literally from Wisconsin and grew up around the Waterton area, and became very involved early on with the American Cancer Society and others, and was really a confidant of President Nixon and others back in the 60s and 70s. So she pushed it at the national level. And then again, Dr. Harold Rush, who I mentioned earlier, was a part of President Nixon's cancer panel to kind of sort these things out. And what they decided in the early 70s and eventually in 1973 with the Cancer Act is to start the war on cancer. And all of us of a certain age remember kind of the the struggles and the eventual relief of polio vaccines and other vaccines that move forward. And clearly the hope at the time was there would be kind of this quick, sudden kind of magical knowledge learned that would get rid of all of cancer, like getting rid of polio for the most part. But what we've learned over these 50 years is that cancer, and a common and appropriate question is, why aren't we curing all of these things? Is the issue at some level is the fact that cancer is many illnesses. There's many types of cancers that people, we've just heard about colon cancer just recently on the call, and we'll likely hear about others. And that what we've also learned is that even within one type of cancer, everyone's a bit different, how they get it, how they respond, et cetera. And that's not an excuse. That's just an explanation of that this is really trying to cure thousands of diseases, not just one. But that doesn't mean we are going to stop. We have to keep moving forward.
Dr. Howard Bailey, our guest, he's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. He's the director of the Carbone Cancer Center and associate dean of oncology at the UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions. What would you like to know about the center? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Dr. Howard Bailey. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the UW Carbone Cancer Center on the show today with our guest, Dr. Howard Bailey. He's the director of the Carbone Cancer Center and associate dean of oncology at the UW-Madison as well. So as we visit with him, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What would you like to know about the center or the research? Have you been a patient? Love to hear your experiences in that way. Join in, give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Bailey, we have Gianni from Montello with a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, good afternoon. My question concerns the role of turmeric in our diet over, say, a lifetime or maybe 4 or 5 decades. Has there been any research on this spice? And when we compare cancer rates with the American culture and diet with those of the Indian and Indonesian diets, has there been any research done that you know of on this spice? As an anti-carcinogen?
Yep, thank you, Johnny. So the answer is yes. So turmeric, the main constituent of turmeric is curcumin. And so that has been studied quite a bit. In fact, some of the research we do here over the years has been leading other centers in studying both nutrients, vaccines, other things in potential ability to prevent cancers. But so there are a lot of spices, other natural products that have evidence to support, at least when we study them in the lab and other things, that they have at least some small or not so small anti-cancer effects. Studies in humans, most of these have been kind of what we call associative or review studies where, and what you're kind of hinting to relative to parts of the world that where cancer rates vary considerably, how much of it is related to diet or other things. Clearly, diet is at least part of it. I think turmeric or those sorts of pigmented spices, there is evidence to support at least some positive effects with it. How much is kind of the big uncertainty? So when we've studied these in people, both in dietary forms or in kind of synthetic forms or taking nutrients and giving them in larger amounts, we have a harder time kind of showing how much it moves the proverbial needle, but diet's important, and having turmeric in your diet, certainly I can't say that that would be bad for anybody, and it may in fact be slightly good. So that is something that we studied and other nutrient-based things quite a bit, actually.
Jenny, thank you so much. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. So we're aware of the ability to cut out cancers or to kill them in situ and then leave the cells, dead cells inside the body. What about treatments for encapsulation? Anything with mRNA, the new process that led to a lot of the COVID vaccine, and then also anything on quantum transportation of for treatments in that realm. I know that's kind of a leap out there, but curious to know what's happening in those areas.
So thank you, Mike. So certainly from a public standpoint, we're much more aware of this mRNA or messenger RNA related to its use in some of the COVID vaccines. So to remind kind of the audience, it's this idea of giving to us or ourselves basically some molecules that are just that. They're the messengers of making certain proteins that that our genes or the chromosomes make or advise each of our cells to do. So there is interest in that platform in cancer. Going back to the origins of kind of what we call gene-based therapy or cancer genetic-based therapy. So it's a platform. There's a lot of interest. There hasn't been, kind of, if you will, clinical breakthroughs quite yet. And the mRNA approach can be used in multiple ways. One is, and can be used similar to the COVID vaccine in terms of trying to enhance our immune system. You can stimulate the production of certain proteins that might be unique to cancer cells, thus helping our immune system recognize them more. We and others are doing actually quite a few studies looking at not just messenger RNA approaches to that, but DNA-based vaccines, protein-based vaccines in ways to stimulate the immune system. Another way to use messenger RNA is to try and, again, signal and have cells produce directly parts of the cells or things that would be toxic internally to the cell, kind of what you're getting at with your what you mentioned, Mike, in the beginning. So there's things ongoing. I can't say to the audience that they're literally on the verge of being out there for large consumption because we haven't really proven their benefits in people yet. But it is an area of a lot of interest. In terms of quantum transportation, and I'm, Mike, I apologize, I might not follow exactly what you're asking. If it's related to kind of electron transfer and the effects that kind of changes in what we call oxygen metabolites, other things that lead to what we call redox or oxidative stress versus reduction in cells, that's something that's been studied for many years to kind of varying degrees of success. As you said, in the lab, we show a lot of things with that. Another aspect you may be getting at is just the concept of how the physical nature within cells can affect how cancer behaves. There's been a lot of work on this campus related to that and literally how the physical formation of certain intracellular and extracellular structures lead to how cancer can behave. So a lot of that is going on. It's not something that I can say to you has materialized in proven effective therapies or prevention techniques yet, but it is things that we and others are studying.
Yeah, Mike, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Questions or comments, give a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. COVID popped up in that conversation. This whole COVID area time period, I'm sure there must have been some negative effects, but maybe some positives as well.
Thank you, Larry. I mean, certainly the negatives we have and at some level continue to live through, which is the isolationism early on, the fact that patients, whether with cancer or other things, were oftentimes isolated by themselves in the hospital. One of the kind of, we worry, longer standing negatives of the pandemic and the COVID kind of publicity is that people stop doing their cancer screenings. And there's been a fair bit of press about that starting, frankly, even a year ago at the, you know, kind of the initial height of the pandemic, that there was worry that people would stop doing their cancer screening or seeing their providers. And a lot of that was based on the fact of what we call cancer modeling data. And I'm going to give a shout out to Dr. Amy Trentham-Dietz, who here at the University of Wisconsin, who was really behind this at a national level, in that much of the data that was presented, which described that there would be, unfortunately, more people dying of breast cancer or colon cancer by missing their cancer screenings, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, that data is derived right here in Wisconsin by Dr. Amy Trentham-Dietz. So the NCI director and others in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, the data they were citing originates from our state, in that Wisconsin is kind of a microcosm of the country at many levels. I'm sure the show talks about it from a political standpoint, but from a medical standpoint, it is as well. In that what happens in our state oftentimes follows or is an example of what happens nationally. And that's certainly the case with cancer screening. So we know from the data derived from all of us that by missing your breast cancer screenings, colorectal cancer screenings, that your risk of developing a more advanced cancer goes up. And it's not something that happens obviously overnight. So as I tell a lot of our audiences, please don't let the pandemic harm you for years to come. It's been bad enough for the last year and a half, but don't let the effects of it start harming you for 5 to 10 years from now as well.
Yeah, very good points. Kathy in Madison, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Yes, Dr. Bailey, I'm wondering. I'm a retired community health educator, and I started with the Cancer Quest Line back in the 70s, and I have a question about whether anybody has data about the major impact that the war on cancer, including the development of the cancer centers around the country, has anybody documented how the public and, you know, the primary care physicians have benefited or changed in terms of their understanding of cancer all these many years later? There was so much, misinformation. There was so much fear. And people with cancer were isolated in their communities because of misunderstandings about contagion and all the rest of it. Do we have good documentation of how this cancer, the war on cancer, has really changed the public as well as practicing physicians' practices?
Thank you, Kathy. So great question, and kind of what is the evidence, if any, to document that this war on cancer has made a significant dent, whether in public perception or just in results? And again, thanks to the work of Kathy and many others, certainly the public is much more aware, which is at least a good starting point. How much the Cancer Act has to do with all that? So back to the question, was there a study of it? There's been some. They haven't been very well done because there's really no way to compare or control for it. We assume that the increased political and public attention to cancer and the increased funding that resulted of it, and the fact that it was even back then a bipartisan sort of held belief that we needed to fund the research to get better at it. I think both through the Cancer Act and others, and again, Kathy's own work, that the message, we've worked hard to get it out. In fact, one of the things we're judged on by the National Cancer Institute here at our Carbone Cancer Center is our ability to educate not just the public, but other providers related to it. So we do surveys and other things to see where people are at with it. And example might be, years ago, we did a survey from various providers on their understanding of what was available for prevention of breast cancer and making sure that they were aware of what was available for that, because there's so much out there that it's part of our job to make sure that people are getting the information, but also us, the public, getting the information too about what are the things that matter the most. We throw so many things out there, I think it's easy for the public to kind of turn it off because either everything causes cancer or everything prevents it, and at the end of the day, it's almost nothing matters because no matter where I turn, it's something good, bad, or in between. So we've tried to work through that. But back to Kathy's question, we assume, and there's some data, but not lots, that the Cancer Act and the development of cancer centers has made a big difference in it because a majority of the big advances in understanding and treatments and prevention originate from these NCI cancer centers and from, you know, our private enterprise partners. But even a lot of their ideas, again, originate from big universities or big cancer centers, what have you. When this all started in 1973, we were the sixth cancer center awarded it. There's now 50 comprehensive cancer centers by the NCI designation around the country, again, serving literally countless millions of people. So there's a lot going on. And again, thanks to those efforts, thanks to Kathy's efforts, we clearly talk more about cancer now than when I was, remembering in the 70s, where it was kind of the unspoken. I remember I'm from a very rural area where way back when we had people die of things and nobody would ever tell us what it was. And frequently it was cancer. And so we're getting better, but I also acknowledge that we all know that there's still considerable room for further improvement as well.
Kathy, thank you so much for calling. Sam in Dubuque, Iowa, your turn. Hi, Sam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My daughter was diagnosed at age 10 with follicular thyroid cancer, which is obviously pretty young. We were lucky enough to see a very astute pediatric endocrinologist there at UW-Madison who helped us diagnose this. They also found thyroid nodules in my youngest daughter at age 6 and also in my husband at age 40. So we were referred to your Wiseman Center, luckily, and went through genetic testing. And about 15 years ago, they found that we had a mutation in a promoter region that may increase their predisposition for thyroid cancer. However, since that time, we've also been tested through a multi-cancer panel for other mutations and found another mutation in them, which could have predisposed them to thyroid cancer at a very young age. So I guess just wanted to talk about, I know it's a personalized decision, but the importance of doing the genetic screening, although I know it's in its infancy, we discovered a mutation, about a year ago that wasn't there 15 years ago. So just the importance of knowing what cancers your family may be predisposed to and be able to screen for those at an earlier age.
Hmm.
So Sam, thank you. That's my apologies on behalf of mankind that you're going through that in the first place, but it's great that you and the people you worked with, picked up on that. So Sam is right that one of the things that has been a big breakthrough over the last decade is just more of an understanding of the genetics of cancer. And I mean that in two ways. There's inheritable genetics, and then there's also just the genetics that aren't inherited that just occur in a cell in relation to the exposures from the environment or just, frankly, time. For all of us as we age, time is a risk factor for cancer because it's just the wear and tear that our cells go through. But back to Sam's point that we are getting a better understanding of that and we are doing more and more of that, especially when things occur in a cluster in a family or at a very early age. So Sam and her providers and she and her family obviously very wisely pursued that. Because when you get a type of thyroid cancer that's normally found in us elderly people, and it's happened in a young person, we know that there's kind of something up with that needs to be looked into. So that is a lot going on. My kind of prediction, not that anybody asked it for it, but is eventually we will get good enough and understand it better enough that all of us will go through kind of genetic testing in some kind and have a better sense of our risks across numbers of illnesses, not just cancer. The reason we're not doing that now is there's so much we don't understand and there's so many false alarms. And we all know that sometimes false alarms can do just as much damage, if not worse, than the actual disease if we start making people do things they don't need to do. So it is an area that we're going to do more and more of. And Sam is absolutely right. If things are unusual or atypical, or if they're happening in multiple kind of clusters, please talk to your provider about should there be some additional genetic testing we should do.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate it. And John in Montello, thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry. I'm going to be that guy just to give a bunch of kudos out to the Carbone Cancer Center. They truly impacted my family in a positive way, and I really appreciate all the things that they do.
Thank you, John. Really appreciate that. Thoughts, and glad to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Well, what are the, in the last minute or so here, what are some of the things that you're looking forward to in the for the center itself and the work it's doing?
Well, I think we are a partner with all of you, all of us, and the communities around us, and trying to address the things that are important to all of us. So trying to do a better job of making sure of all of our fellow citizens, all our communities benefit from aspects of cancer screening, cancer early diagnosis, cancer prevention, and cancer therapy. We know that that's something we've got to keep improving on, that a lot of our communities don't get access or get those benefits. So we're trying to work on improving that. We are putting a lot of time and effort into cancer prevention. Kind of back to the old saying that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, that infamous cancer researcher, Ben Franklin. So we'll stick with that as well. So we're working on, we've been doing one of the first in the world breast cancer vaccine studies to see if we can prevent breast cancer with a vaccine. We're going to be doing that with some other studies. We've done the nutrients as well. So that's some of the stuff we're going after. And then just continuing to try and improve our understanding of cancer so that we can apply that to those of us or any of us who unfortunately get cancer to have a better chance of living well for as long as possible, preferably getting rid of it so that it never shows up again, but at a minimum, living better. Because with any illness, whether you get rid of it or not, the bottom line is you want to live well and you'd like to keep living well. And that's our goal for all of us.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion for me, and I want to thank you, Dr. Bailey, for the work that you do and for the work of all of the people at the Carbone Cancer Center. It's an amazing facility, and you have the gratitude of, I think, everyone here in the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Thank you so much for being
Thanks,
with
Larry.
Us. Dr. Howard Bailey directs the Carbone Cancer Center, also an Associate Dean of Oncology at the UW-Madison. We'll try to get him back and talk with him again. Wonderful conversation. I really appreciate his time for sure. Looking ahead to tomorrow, we'll talk about building, placing, and maintaining birdhouses with our guest from the National Audubon Society. And then Dr. Doug Tallamy will be with us to talk about the interaction between animals, insects, and plants, and how that interaction promotes diversity. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.